Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I started to feel that there was an element of unhealthfulness to competitive eating. I know that's a shocking revelation.
That's partly why author and journalist Ryan Nurz ended up leaving his job as an announcer of eating contests. Just in time for a 4th of July tradition, Nathan's hot dog eating contest, Nurz gives us an inside look at the world of professional competitive eaters. Drought conditions in certain states translate to dollar signs for other states. Harvest Public Media looks at the changing landscape of American beef production. And Chef Daniel Orr has been cooking light, fresh dishes for us lately. Two more vegetarian recipes today that highlight seasonal produce. Food News Headlines. Luann Johnson is with us.
Last week, we reported on a study that tried to explain why foods labeled with healthy buzzwords like all natural seem more healthy. Well, this week, our blogger Chad Bouchard reports that some companies are making healthy modifications to their foods in secret to avoid scaring customers away. Notoriously unhealthy products like cookies and French fries don't attract health seekers, the companies argue, so reducing salt and fat are not really selling points. Their decisions are backed by research. For example, a 2012 study from Deakin University in Australia showed that participants did not like low-salt labeled soups as much as the same soup with a normal label and would add extra salt to compensate. Jennifer Harris is the director of marketing initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. She supports the company's choice to make changes quietly, saying it's a smart strategy. In some cases, experience also supports the use of a so-called stealth health strategy. McDonald's was barraged with complaints in 2002 after announcing they were reducing trans fats. Boston Market cut sodium from many of its side dishes last year, but decided not to advertise the change, according to the Wall Street Journal. A previous experiment in removing salt shakers from tables did not sit well with the chain's regulars. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has totaled up the planted grain acres for the season, offering the first glimpse of production for 2014. And as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, Midwest farmers remain committed to corn and soybeans.
Farmers planted a record number of soybean acres this season, but corn is flat in several Midwestern states, while down slightly in others. Overall, about 4 million fewer acres were planted in corn this year, down 4% from last year. USDA's Anthony Prilliman says many farmers are sticking with what has worked during a run of good years.
Definitely weather concerns, economic concerns, all that goes into what the farmers end up deciding what they're going to plant.
He says persistent drought conditions may have contributed to lower corn acres in Kansas, Colorado, and the Dakotas. Still, nationally, this year's planting is among the largest in decades. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And the University of California announced plans for a comprehensive food initiative this week. Goals of the initiative include heightening the collective purchasing power and dining practices on all campuses to encourage sustainable farming practices. This could open the door for small growers to serve as suppliers. The UC Global Food Initiative will go in effect across all 10 campuses. We post stories like these all day, every day on Twitter. Follow us at Earth Eats.
Links to read more about these stories at eartheats.org. Luann Johnson. Till next week.
Thanks, Annie.
For a long time, Texas was the center of cattle country, but drought is reshaping the beef map and raising the price of steak. Ranchers are moving their herds from California to Colorado and from Texas to Nebraska by the thousands. They're seeking refuge from dry weather, and as Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, cattle producers in the Midwest are making the most of it.
Drought in the South has the cattle industry looking north. In fact, this year, for the first time, Nebraska passed Texas as the top cattle feeding state in the country.
This is the garden spot for it, to feed cattle. I'm one of the lucky ones that I found it.
Terry Van Housen feeds cattle near Stromsburg in eastern Nebraska. His feed yard has 2 miles of concrete bunks. 8,000 animals are lined up, piling on the pounds. These calves started on pastures scattered throughout the region. This is their last stop before heading for the slaughterhouse.
When the motel is full, like a feed yard or a packing plant or going full blast, that's when they make money. But if you can't keep the motel full, then that's when the profits go down.
If Nebraska's cattle motels have fewer vacancies these days, it's largely because ranchers in the southern plains have emptied out parched pastures, waiting for a rainy day. Daryl Peel is a livestock marketing specialist at Oklahoma State University.
You know, western Oklahoma, the panhandle of Texas, and in fact much of West Texas and much of New Mexico are still in extremely severe drought. There's been very little relief really since the fall of 2010.
When rainstorms hit southwest Oklahoma over the Memorial Day weekend, it was the first time in 4 years rancher Cody Goodnight remembers seeing more than an inch of rain fall at once. Goodnight says it went straight into the soil.
You know, it's hard to get runoff when you got cracks in the ground that are 2 inches wide.
But one good rain can't wipe out a four-year dry spell. Goodnight would normally run around 1,000 calves on his native prairie pastures. Over the past 4 years, he hasn't had the grass or water to graze more than half that.
There's certainly some bigger ponds that have never been dry that are dry now. You know, my dad built a lot of the ponds back in the 50s and 60s, and he'd never seen them dry.
Ponds are drying up and herds are shrinking in Oklahoma and Texas. And that's important if you ever buy steaks or hamburger to throw on the grill. Low cattle numbers are a big reason meat prices are so high. But Daryl Peel at Oklahoma State says that's been a long time coming.
The drought the last 3 years has been the last straw, if you will, of a long series of events. The U.S. beef cow herd has been downsizing for 16 of the last 18 years.
But the bottom dropped out when the drought hit Texas in 2011. Since then, the U.S. cattle herd has shrunk by 1.8 million head, or 6%. Those losses are concentrated in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. Meanwhile, northern states like Nebraska, Iowa, and the Dakotas have seen their herds grow, even though many pastures have been plowed up to raise corn. Peel says it's part of a larger structural change in the beef industry.
It favors cattle feeding in the Midwest and less so in the southern plains. It also favors less cow-calf production in the Midwest and moving the cow herd proportionately back to the central plains and the western part of the U.S.
Peel says even after the grass is green again in Texas, Nebraska is likely to hold on to the cattle feeding crown it gained this year. So why are more cattle heading north for supper? A feed truck rolls by, dumping feed into the bunks at the Van Housen feedlot in Nebraska. They mix 22 loads a day, nearly 200 tons of feed. And it's what's in that feed that gives Nebraska an edge.
Come right out of the plant.
Terry Van Housen takes me to the feed pit to show me a fresh pile of wet distiller's grain, corn that's been run through a nearby ethanol plant. I pick up a dull yellow clump, and it's moist and still warm.
You can eat it if you want, but it's awful bitter. It kind of sticks together.
Yeah. You can throw that glob on the fender of your car, and it'll still be there when you get to Lincoln.
These leftovers of corn ethanol production are the key to Nebraska's new position at the front of the cattle feeding industry. Ethanol plants consume huge amounts of corn, but they also put out distiller's grains that can be used as inexpensive feed.
So that's a big deal. See, a lot of this stuff, if you fed in Texas, it'd have to come from here.
And as Van Housen says, it's cheaper to take the cattle to the feed than take the feed to the cattle. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. To the kitchen, first thing today. Last week, Chef Daniel Orr cooked up some kale and bok choy. Today, it's more greens.
You know, during the summertime, you may hear a lot of dishes about cooked greens on Earth Eats, but that's because in the summer, there are a lot of greens to use up. So you want to use them in different ways, make them taste interesting.
His green of choice today is collards, cooked with some Asian flavors like ginger, sesame seeds, and oyster sauce. Maybe not something you have in your kitchen, but this recipe could inspire you to stock up. Let's listen.
I've got a big pan on. Now, you know, this is probably a 12-inch to 14-inch diameter pan. people think, wow, that's a huge pan to cook for four people or whatever. But what it does give you is a large surface area. So there's a lot of heat exposure. So you'll cook very quickly on this. If you want to heat it up nice and hot, we're going to add 3 tablespoons of oil. Our favorite Asian ingredients. We've got our garlic. Got our ginger, about a tablespoon and a half. Our garlic is starting to brown.
Really fast on that.
Yeah, since it's a big pan. Okay, we're going to throw our greens in, and that's going to help stop the cooking so the garlic won't burn. Anytime if you get nervous about your garlic burning, quickly add a cold ingredient such as onions or greens or whatever, and stir it, and that will keep the garlic from continuing to cook. Okay, oyster sauce is not, a lot of times, does not really have any seafood in it. It's the sauce they use on oyster dishes. That's why they call it oyster sauce. Okay, if you don't want to use that, you can always use hoisin sauce, which is also a thick, savory, sweet sauce. Got some crushed red pepper flakes, sesame seeds, 2 teaspoons of orange zest. Okay, I'm just going to add a little bit of water to this. Got a little bit of brown on the bottom of my pan. I want to release that by adding a touch of water.
Because that's the good stuff, right?
That's the flavor. Okay, and that is all there is to it.
Chef Daniel Orr will be back in the second half with an Italian-inspired salad recipe, which would be perfect to bring to a picnic. Picnics are a 4th of July tradition, of course. Another sort of weird Independence Day tradition is the world-famous Nathan's International Hot Dog Eating Contest. Last year, Joey Chestnut broke his own world record by chowing down on 69 hot dogs in 10 minutes. He'll be seeking his 8th straight title this year in the 98th annual contest. We wanted to know more about the All-American event from someone on the inside. Ryan Nurs worked as a contest announcer for the International Federation of Competitive Eating, the IFOCE, and he wrote a book about it, Eat This Book, A Year of Gorging and Glory on the Competitive Eating Circuit. He came into our studios to speak with WFIU's John Bailey.
You mentioned that you announced one of these contests. You announced several of these contests.
Yes.
You found yourself in the employ of the International Federation of Competitive Eating, a.k.a. Major League Eating. How in the world did that happen?
I have friends in low places, John. No, really, a good friend of mine named Dave Baer, who shared a sort of similar absurd sense of humor, and he found himself with the Shea Brothers in New York, some guys who did publicity and sort of had also an absurd sense of humor, and they got involved in the Nathan's Famous contest. So Dave Baer started working for the IFOCE, and one day he called me and said, hey, look, I've got this gig in Natchitoches, Louisiana. It's a meat pie eating contest. And he's like, you just got to go down there, wear a suit, wear a straw hat, and be a carnival barker and get up there on stage and, you know, dictate the contest. And it became a career, you know, a career move, oddly enough. And I think I ended up overall announcing well over 100 eating contests. Went to Singapore, did chicken satay in Singapore, mincemeat pies in outside of London, did raw onions in Maui. So yeah, it was quite a not so glamorous but interesting career.
How did you end up falling out with professional competitive eating?
I started to feel that there was an element of unhealthfulness to competitive eating. I know that's a shocking revelation, but and you know, I became friends with all these guys. You know, all these guys were my buddies. You know, so I started to know some of their habits of, you know, preparing and winding down, let's say, from these contests. And there was some concerns about it, and also, you know, it was really funny at first. It's very fun and funny, and it really is. But people aren't eating contests aren't thriving because people are buying tickets. So it's all about sponsorships and you know, food companies like Nathan's Famous and festivals and things like that will sponsor it. So you have to sort of mute any negative messages. And we called whenever someone would vomit, we called that a reversal of fortune. or so, and we had all kinds of terms like that. You know, Elvis just left the building. You say things like that. And that was an immediate, you know, you immediately disqualified from the contest if that happened during the contest. But, you know, those kinds of things after a while, I just felt, you know, I couldn't really suppress it anymore. And I couldn't as a sort of intelligent adult continue to push it as totally positive and funny and okay.
In the book, you profile a number of professional eaters who represent both sexes, a variety of races and geographical regions, and a range of sizes. What's true of all these competitors? Is there a common thread?
I think the common threads are they found out sometime in their life that they naturally are fast eaters. Not necessarily that they all had massive capacity. People think that that's what competitive eating is about. But these are all speed contests. Some of them came from big families where eating fast was literally very important. You know, you only had so much food, and if you had a bunch of big brothers, you knew you had to get to it fast. Beyond that, all of them, I think, have a real taste for sort of camaraderie and wanting something outside of their mundane, normal lives. They all have normal jobs, but they want something like to be sort of weekend warriors and have a bunch of buddies. And that's the next thing, is I think, is the media part of it. So a guy who's way overweight and then is a real estate, you know, guy in Long Island all of a sudden has a blog, a Twitter feed, a Facebook page with a bunch of likes and people talking about you, and you go on media interviews. So I think a little bit of it is that celebrity culture. And most of them have a pretty good sense of humor. Most of them get it. The Shea brothers at the IFOC are very funny. I did my best to make it funny as well. And most of them get that what they're doing is pretty hilarious and a spectacle that people won't forget.
Ryan Nurz talking about his time in the world of professional competitive eating. He's a freelance journalist from Columbus, Indiana. Listen to John Bailey's complete conversation with Ryan Nurz at eartheats.org. Coming up...
You can look and you can see these colors. I mean, it looks like an Italian flag. You got the white mozzarella, the green basil, and the red tomatoes.
No, this is not a caprese salad. A couple additional ingredients make this something even more interesting, I think. Daniel Orr with more snacks coming up after this. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick, Cadillac Boulevard, and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Our friends at WTIU's The Weekly Special visited Willowfield Lavender Farm in Mooresville, Indiana recently, and they spoke with owner Kieran O'Connor. Here's their story.
Behind me, 15 years ago, was a cornfield. Knowing that I was getting ready to retire from the Indianapolis Fire Department, I wanted to grow something here and have a small business instead of going to work for someone else. My wife, Libby, at 5 o'clock in the morning woke me up one day and said, how about lavender? And I said, cool, that'd be great. So we became the first lavender farm in the state. We put 100 plants in the ground and we were off and running. There are hundreds of varieties of lavender that grow all over the world. We've gotten it down to 4. We have 2 hybrid lavenders. The strongest smelling is probably Grosso. It can get 7 foot wide on the West Coast. Here it gets about half of that because of our winters. Then the other one is Provence. It's the cooking lavender. At one time we had 35 different varieties of lavender here, and these have been the proven ones that have come down. Lavender needs at least 6 hours of hot sun every day. It needs well-drained soil, rocky, limey. It likes it on the alkaline side. And do not overwater it. I'm telling you, after 12 years, I still don't feel like an expert. The plants always tell me something different. They are the experts, and they are always teaching me. There's something new every year. And that's what keeps us stimulated. The weeding, all that is done by hand. There are no sprays. There are no herbicides or pesticides. Besides, there are so many neat little bugs that are around here that if you spray, you never get to enjoy those things. Lavender has just kind of become a culture. And so we have a little retail shop in our barn where we sell these products, lotions and soaps and candles and sachets. 15 years ago, I was probably crawling down some hallway with a top floor of a building on fire. I thought that was a pretty stimulating, exciting lifestyle as it was, but to go from that to a gentleman farmer as growing lavender, no, I had no idea I would be doing this. We just have this lifestyle that is just constantly stimulated and creative, so it's all good.
It's at times like this when I wish radio had smell-o-vision. This farm was so aromatic. There's a video that goes with this interview as well. Watch it by searching for The Weekly Special from eartheats.org. Okay, so you already do all of your own cooking, you tend a garden, you preach the DIY lifestyle. Well, have you tried making your own wheelbarrow or even a chicken coop? Spike Carlson says it's not as daunting as it might sound.
You know, and it's a lot like cooking. You start out with a project that's small, and you gain a few ingredients and a few more tools, and you have a success, and then you move up to the next thing.
Carlson has been a carpenter for 15 years, and he's written for the Family Handyman magazine. His new book is The Backyard Homestead Book of Building Projects. He prototyped every project in this book, which means his backyard is packed with stuff. That and his 5 kids have been getting lots of handy gifts over the years. The one project that caught my eye was the flower pot smoker. Here's Spike Carlson.
Yeah, it's pretty fun, and it's just made out of 2 flower pots, and you need an electric hot plate, and you need some wood chips that you would use for in your barbecue grill, and a couple bricks to kind of get things propped up. And you cannot do a side of beef in this, but you can do a nice brisket or a nice small chicken. It's just kind of wacky, yet it works, and the food tastes good, and it's actually a pretty good beginner project. I've enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Anne.
Yeah, have a good one.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye. We'll post links for how you can construct your own flower pot smoker at eartheats.org. Spike Carlson is a carpenter and the author of The Backyard Homestead Book of Building Projects. Connect with him at spike.carlsen.com.
All right, well, we're going to be going to Italy on this recipe.
In the kitchen again with Chef Orr. He's drawn to Italian cooking because those recipes are all about letting the ingredients speak for themselves. This recipe features some tomatoes and cucumbers. The fresher, the better with those. But then also an ingredient that's past its prime. Grab those stale bits from your loaves of bread. Here's how to use them in a panzanella salad.
Almost every culture has a way to use day-old bread. You have you know, French toast, which the French call pain perdu, which means forgotten bread. The panzanella salad is a perfect example of that. We use bread from Scholar's Inn, which is a local bakery, and this is their grain bread. I've baked these off as croutons with some Parmesan cheese, olive oil, salt, and pepper. Now, since these are quite dry, I'm going to just add about a quarter cup of hot water and toss those in there, and that's going to start moistening those up as I ready the other ingredients. All right, so I added for 6 people, I added 2 small rounds of fresh mozzarella, and to that I'm going to add 1 medium red onion cut into julienne, which are fine strips.
Now some beautiful sun-dried tomatoes, same thing.
Yep, we're going to roughly chop those. And so the sun-dried tomatoes are going to give it kind of a deep, rich, sweet, almost raisiny tomato flavor. Then I've got our globe tomatoes, which are the big round tomatoes. Okay, to that we're going to also add some cherry tomatoes. And with cherry tomatoes, I always like to cut them in half, because when you try to chase them around the plate with a fork, they kind of shoot off the plate or they squirt you in the eye. So do you and your guests a favor and cut your cherry tomatoes in half. Okay, I've got some great basil. Now look at this jumbo basil. My mother brought it up from Gibson County. Now I'm going to smash some garlic, so I've got these peeled cloves. And then what I'd like to do after I've got it pretty much chopped is take the side of your knife and just press it down there, and you're going to smash that, and that's going to bring out those essential oils and those flavors of the garlic, almost make like a paste. I've got a little herbe de Provence, some summer savory, thyme, a little bit of rosemary. And basically now we're just going to build the vinaigrette right on top of this. We don't have to make the vinaigrette separately.
Get your hands dirty, people. That's what the chef's doing.
You can look and you can see these colors. I mean, it looks like an Italian flag. You got that white mozzarella, the green basil, and the red tomatoes. All those beautiful Italian colors. Now we're just going to squeeze some lemon juice over it. And then we're going to season it with some salt and pepper. Okay, I'm going to toss that. And again, of course, we're going to give it a taste. The bread's perfect. It still has a little crunch to it. It looks good. Looks like we're there.
A tomato tip from the chef: don't refrigerate them. You get the best flavor and texture if you store them at room temperature. These recipes are on our website, along with tips for growing tomatoes, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Spike Carlson, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Ryan Nurs, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Enjoy the holiday weekend, guys. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.